The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. The first article is from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the April 2021 issue, and it's entitled, Having One Chronic Condition Can Boost the Risk for Others. If you have certain disorders, it may be time to get health screenings and try to prevent more problems. Chronic disease is a scourge of older age. About 85% of people age 60 or older have at least one such condition, and 60% have at least two. The numbers can climb even higher. Some diseases seem to go hand in hand, so having one automatically increases your risk for developing another. A vicious cycle. Some of the most common chronic conditions are very closely related, like obesity, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, and heart disease. Many of these conditions are risk factors for each other, creating a domino effect. If one is not controlled, it raises the risk of developing another. For example, obesity can lead to type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure. Those conditions damage blood vessel walls. That damage makes blood vessels more susceptible to cholesterol deposits, especially if you have high blood levels of cholesterol. Plaque buildup on the blood vessel wall leads to blood vessel stiffness, narrowing, and blockages called atherosclerosis. And atherosclerosis leads to cardiovascular disease, like heart attack or stroke. Other related problems include vision loss from damaged blood vessels in the eyes, erectile dysfunction in men, narrowed blood vessels in the extremities called peripheral artery disease, which can result in amputation, chronic kidney disease, which can lead to kidney failure. Even if risk factors are well controlled, a study published online November 20th of 2020 in Circulation suggested that diabetes still raises the risk for cardiovascular disease by 21%. The reason for this excess cardiovascular risk isn't well understood, but we often don't diagnose diabetes until sometime after it starts, so we don't have the opportunity to control risk factors from the beginning. Also, we only have a small number of patients with all of those risk factors controlled, says Dr. David M. Nathan, director of the Diabetes Center and Clinical Research Center at Massachusetts General. Many other chronic conditions are linked to each other. One example is autoimmune conditions in which your immune system mistakenly attacks your own body's tissues, as if they were a foreign invader. These conditions include type 1 diabetes, an attack on cells that make insulin, the hormone that helps cells extract sugar from the blood, Hashimoto's disease, which is an attack on the thyroid gland, and rheumatoid arthritis, which is an attack on the linings of the joints. Autoimmune diseases tend to run in clusters. Once you have one, you're more vulnerable to others because your immune system has a basic defect, Dr. Nathan says. For example, if you have Hashimoto's disease, you have a 14% chance of developing another autoimmune disease, far greater than people who don't have any autoimmune diseases. Here are some other examples of associations between chronic conditions. Hearing loss and cognitive decline. Hearing loss can decrease the ability to communicate. This can impair a person's social interactions, which may increase the risk of developing dementia. Some experts believe hearing loss might be changing the brain's structure, making it more susceptible to dementia, says Dr. Elliot Kozin, an otologist, which means a hearing specialist, at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Another example is obesity and joint problems. In addition to obesity's role in cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, obesity also puts a strain on your joints, hastening the wearing away of cartilage. Obstructive sleep apnea and high blood pressure. Obstructive sleep apnea is characterized by temporary pauses in breathing during sleep, which occur when the tongue or throat tissue blocks the airway. During each apnea, oxygen levels drop and put stress on the heart. The apnea ends with a brief arousal from sleep, accompanied by a surge in stress hormones and an increase in heart rate and blood pressure. Over time, this permanently changes blood vessels and increases blood pressure, says Dr. Lawrence Epstein, a sleep specialist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. What you should do. If you have any chronic conditions, it's important to ask your doctor about the risk for associated diseases. In some cases, you should get a health screening. People with sleep apnea should be screened for high blood pressure. Doctors should ask people with high blood pressure questions to determine if they might have sleep apnea. If you have high blood pressure and your doctor hasn't asked you about sleep problems, you should bring it up. For type 1 or 2 diabetes, we'll check blood pressure, kidney function, and cholesterol levels, Dr. Nathan says. You'll also need regular checks of your feet and eyes to detect early problems and prevent severe ones. In other cases, additional screening isn't automatic. Hearing loss diagnosed on routine hearing tests does not automatically warrant formal testing for dementia. However, if someone has developed new cognitive problems, then this type of testing should absolutely be explored, Dr. Kozin advises. And in all cases, ask what you can do to reduce your risk for other chronic conditions. You don't want to be surprised by complications, says Dr. Nathan, especially if they could have been treated or prevented. Now we're going to turn to the section called Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, Editor-in-Chief. The first question is, can we restore memories we've lost? How do we restore memories in our brain? And is there hope that someday we might be able to restore memories we've lost? The answer is, we remember just a tiny fraction of the events of our lives. The sights and sounds of every conscious moment could become a memory, but only when a moment seems important do we remember it, at least for a while. I remember the radiant beauty of my wife's face on our wedding day, at the moment she lifted the veil. You ask what is happening when we store away a memory and when we remember it. In the past 30 years, we've begun to understand. To transform a moment into an actual short-term memory, we store that memory in pieces, each piece stored in a different brain region. The different pieces contain the sight, the sound, the emotional reaction we had at the time, the place that it happened, and when it happened relative to other memories. Collectively, all of these pieces of the memory are knitted together into what is called a memory engram, that's E-N-G-R-A-M, a coherent combination of all the pieces. The knitting is accomplished by strengthening the connections between brain cells. Moments judged important prompt stronger connections. To recall a specific memory, a part of the brain called the hippocampus retrieves the engram. the index of the different brain regions where the pieces of that memory are stored. Recent experiments in mice show that if the hippocampus is temporarily impaired, access to a memory will be temporarily lost. The hippocampus briefly forgets the engram that links together the pieces of the memory. But the memory is still there, stored away in those brain regions. When this research was published, some wondered if it meant that some lost memories could be restored in humans. A cognitive scientist, my colleague Dr. Andrew Budson, says there are two ways that memories can be lost as we get older. One is simply that we haven't found the right cue to access the memory. With the right cue, seeing the right person, hearing the right music, or smelling the right odor, we can suddenly recall the entire memory. The memory engram is intact, but memories also degrade over time, which unfortunately happens to most old memories. Most lost memories in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias are degraded and probably can never be retrieved. We're beginning to understand the physical and chemical connections that occur in the brain when memories are formed and recalled. Memory isn't magic. Science is figuring it out. That's exciting, but not as exciting as being able, whenever I want, to summon the memory of my wife's face at the moment we were wed. That's the end of Dr. Komarov's comments. The next article is Tips to Retrieve Old Memories. Details of significant experiences from decades ago may still be available if you can coax them out of your memory. Sometimes memories of certain experiences remain crystal clear for life, like the moment you said, "I do," or the first time you held your baby in your arms. Other significant memories from long ago can be harder to recall. They may still be with you. It just takes effort to retrieve them. Of the many memories you accumulate every day, only those marked as meaningful are recorded in your brain's long-term files. We have a system in our brains that tags memories that are important in some way, so we'll remember them in the future, says Dr. Andrew Budson, a neurologist and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at VA Boston Healthcare System. Two things tag a memory as special. The first is emotion. Getting married is an example of a highly emotional event. In that circumstance, a whole host of brain chemicals become active as these memories are being recorded, Dr. Budson says. The second thing is personal significance. You probably remember what you had for breakfast this morning and what clothes you wore yesterday, but if I were to ask you about those in a few days or months, you'd have no memories for them because they're just not that important to you, Dr. Budson explains. Aging affects retrieval. Sometimes even special or important memories are harder to remember. Several age-related factors contribute to this memory loss of recall. The first is that memory goes downhill after age 30. There is good evidence that our ability to retrieve information peaks between age 20 and 30. By the time we're in our 50s, the frontal lobes, which are in charge of searching for memories, don't work as well as they used to, Dr. Budson says. Also, memories fade with time. If you haven't thought about a memory in years, it won't be as vivid or strong as it used to be. By not revisiting the memory, you're telling your brain it's not important, and other memories might be laid on top of it, Dr. Budson says. So we need help to jog our memory. When we're younger, an internal clue, just thinking of something, can help retrieve a memory, Dr. Budson says. But when we're older, we rely more on external cues to retrieve memories, like a sound or an image. Cue the memory. To reactivate an old memory, you must think about the senses that were engaged as the memory was being recorded. That's because, as you experience something special or important, your perceptions, images, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, thoughts, or feelings were being stored in one part of the brain, the cortex, and then bound together as a memory by another part of the brain, the hippocampus, and tagged so that frontal lobes could retrieve the pattern of information later. A cue from your environment, like hearing a song, or a cue that you generate, like thinking about your high school graduation, can help you retrieve a memory. The more specific the cues are for the episode of life you're trying to remember, the more likely it is you'll have a pattern match and pull up an old memory, Dr. Budson says. Because you may not spontaneously recall cues related to a long-forgotten memory, you'll have to generate some. Dr. Budson recommends that you try these strategies. Look at old photographs of your home, your family, or friends. Read a poem you wrote or liked to read when you were younger. Hold an old article of clothing you saved. Read an old letter, personal journal, or newspaper article. Listen to an old song that you or someone in your family loved. Cook a meal your mom or dad used to make for you. Smell something that may jog your memory, like a book, a pillow, perfume, or food. Visit a place from your younger days. Watch an old movie or TV show. Be still as you try to summon old memories. Close your eyes at times and focus on the sights, the sounds, the smells, thoughts, and feelings associated with each one. And when you do recall memories, write them down and reinforce them by visiting them often in your mind if they're pleasing or helpful. You really can travel back in time to a particular experience in your life, Dr. Budson says, and cueing one memory will often lead to another. The next article is called, and again, this is from the Harvard Health Letter of April 2021, Imaging Overload: How Many Tests Are Too Many? Diagnostic technology makes it possible to detect many conditions. But is it safe to get a lot of x-rays or CT scans? When your doctor orders an occasional x-ray or CT scan, you probably focus on the findings, not the amount of radiation you'll be exposed to. But if you need numerous tests, you may wonder if you're getting too much radiation exposure and how it may affect you. The concern about radiation exposure is an increased risk for developing cancer later in life. Ionizing radiation from tests like x-rays or CT scans has the potential to damage tissue in the body, including cellular DNA. As DNA is damaged, this causes mutations. Some of these are repaired by our cells, but others escape repair. In rare circumstances, these mutations may cause cells to divide rapidly without control, says Dr. Mark Hammer, a radiologist with Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. If cancer were to develop, it could take 10 to 20 years for it to become apparent. So how big is the risk? We have very limited data on the link between diagnostic testing and future cancer development. Some older observational studies estimated that 1.5% to 2% of cancers in the United States might be attributable to CT scans. This would be 29,000 new cases per year and 15,000 deaths. But that estimate was based on the amount of radiation from older diagnostic imaging machines. We've been able to decrease radiation doses for every type of scan we do in the last 10 to 15 years because of advances in technology, cameras, and computer processing, Dr. Hammer notes. That reduces the already small risk of the diagnostic imaging causing cancer. For example, the amount of radiation in an X-ray of your hand or your foot is about the same as 3 hours of exposure to normal background radiation from the environment. Other factors affect risk too, like varying targets. Beams of radiation aimed at different parts of the body over the years don't add up to one cumulative risk. The concern is repeated exposure to the same cells, not exposure to the wrist for one X-ray, the head for one CT scan, or the spine and hip for one bone density scan, Dr. Hammer points out. Radiation is most dangerous to children and to young people who have more cell division occurring than older people and a longer lifespan in which to develop cancer. But even into your 60s, there is time for cancer to develop. Above age 70, the risk of getting cancer from testing is very small, and you really don't need to be concerned about it, Dr. Hammer says. For people 70 and younger, getting a diagnostic test once in a blue moon is likely to provide crucial information to guide treatment, and it isn't believed to pose much of a cancer risk. But frequent diagnostic testing may slightly increase cancer risk and should be weighed carefully. In some cases, repeated tests are worth the risk. For example, there is a clear benefit to doing CT in a person with cancer every few months to know if the chemotherapy is working, or to screen a former smoker annually for lung cancer, Dr. Hammer says. But unnecessary diagnostic tests, which may account for about a third of all CT scans, should be avoided. The consensus of experts is that there is no safe threshold of radiation, and that increasing amounts of radiation lead to increasing risk of cancer, Dr. Hammer says. Anytime your doctor orders a test, you should ask, what's the test expected to show, what the doctor will do with the information, and whether it will affect treatment, what can be done to reduce the radiation dose, and whether any alternative tests are available. A subheading within this article is entitled Radiation Exposure. We're exposed to natural radiation every day. It's in the air, the rocks, the soil and water, and even the food and drinks we consume. In a year's time, the average person is exposed to about 3 millisieverts, which are called MSV, of this background radiation. Radiation that travels through the air and penetrates tissue, which is called ionizing radiation, is used for medical purposes, like in X-rays, bone density tests, dental X-rays, CT scans, and positron emission tomography, which is called PET scans. The doses of ionizing radiation in the tests vary. For example, there is only 0.001 millisievert in a bone density test, and only 0.005 millisieverts in a dental X-ray. But there is 0.4 millisieverts in a mammogram, 1.5 millisieverts in a lung cancer CT screen, 2.1 millisieverts in a head CT scan, 12 millisieverts in CT angiography, 16 millisieverts in CT scans of the abdomen and pelvis with contrast, and 25 millisieverts in a combined PET scan, CAT scan. It also points out that the doses may be lower depending on the center that performs the scan. Finally, a brief article, How Much Will Fried Foods Harm Your Heart? Fried foods carry health risks in part because they spur inflammation. But how many servings of crispy French fries does it take to raise your risk for cardiovascular disease? Not many, unfortunately, suggests a large analysis published online January 18, 2021 by the journal Heart. Scientists pooled the findings of 17 studies on fried foods and problems like heart attacks, clogged coronary arteries, heart failure, and stroke. The studies included more than 500,000 people. Researchers also looked at the data from another 6 studies, assessing the association of eating fried food and dying prematurely. Those studies involved 750,000 people. People who ate the most fried foods were 28% more likely to have heart problems compared with people who ate the least. Every additional 4-ounce serving of fried foods per week bumped up the overall risk by 3%. But the analysis failed to show that people who ate lots of fried foods were more likely to die prematurely. Besides provoking inflammation, fried foods are often high in sodium, as well as harmful saturated fats. If you choose to indulge in them, do it sparingly, and avoid foods fried in animal fats. Choose foods fried in vegetable oils instead. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you.